Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the OIES China Energy Program. My name is Anders Hovey, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute, and I'm joined today by colleagues Michal Maidan and Philip Andrew Speed. And today, we're talking about China's first half energy developments and statistics and touching on a few important new themes. First of all, the macroeconomic data, what it does and doesn't mean for energy demand in China. Secondly, gas policy and price reforms, and then an update on the power sector, coal, renewables, power outages, news of John Kerry's climate talks in Beijing, and finally, China's recent restrictions on exports of key minerals. So with that introduction, Michal, the second quarter GDP and other macroeconomic data are now out, and it seems like they have missed expectations. What is the macro environment looking like, and what are the policy responses that you see? How does this affect energy demand?
So the data came out, and as you said, weaker than market expectations. And I think this is probably the second or third time that we've been saying this. And we're not macroeconomists and we're not forecasters, but we have been saying from the beginning of the year that we shouldn't expect a big bang and a big recovery in China. Having said that, the GDP in Q2 came in at 6.3% year on year. That was a full percentage point below market expectations. But the kind of the data kept showing really weak and worrying trends. Youth unemployment is at new records. June sales of cars, office products, kind of consumer goods were all down. Retail sales were up by a very weak, considering sort of historical precedents, 3% in June. Fixed asset investments also quite weak. Private firms are cutting investments, real estate investment dropping. So really all of that pointing to ongoing weakness or just a slow recovery, even though there are some positive points. So markets are worried. I think the data isn't sort of dismal. I don't think the government is panicking and worrying that it can't meet its around 5% GDP growth target for the year. We also had the Politburo meeting, which is sort of the quarterly meeting to do kind of macro guidance in July. None of the readouts suggested panic, right? They talked about trying to support consumption, again, not giving any kind of handouts to consumers, but reinstating EV subsidies, talking. And I think perhaps the most interesting thing has been very consistent support to the private sector. But again, that's coming through easing some of the investment climate and trying to improve medium to longer term, the kind of operating environment for private enterprise. Nobody seems to have really bought into it quite yet, but I think as long as the signals come in consistently, then I think we could see a bit of support. But all that means that any expectations of yet again another big bang or another kind of big increase in activity or stimulus or funding, and local government debt is still problematic, and the government is sort of talking about coming up with a plan to A, figure out what the extent of hidden debt is and then how to deal with it. Those are the things that we should expect. So government doesn't seem to be panicked. It does seem to be looking at sort of more sustainable responses. And it does feel like, and we'll talk about it as well for energy, we're back into sort of reform mode or thinking about some of the fundamental policies and the way these sectors are going to behave rather than firefighting to a certain degree. But I think, as you alluded to, the macro data and energy data are at a little bit of a disconnect. I mean, oil demand is up, or at least implied oil demand is up at around 13% year on year. Really high demand for gasoline and diesel and crude imports are up. And I think we talked about this last time. A lot of it is on the supply sides of sort of cheap inputs coming in, a lot of stock building, both for crude, for diesel. The consumption side of it has yet to appear, and that has to, at some point, balance itself out, either through higher exports for products, which we're starting to see, and perhaps slower throughputs and less run rates. But that bit of it is still showing a little bit of a disconnect. But I guess I can turn that around to you, Anders, right? There have been droughts, there have been floods, ongoing concerns about power outages. A month ago, we talked about how renewable capacity is being added at a furious pace. Where are we with that? A, sort of is power demand showing us something about the economy that we didn't know? Is it more about the power sector? And what did the kind of first half data and statistics tell us about how the sector is shaping up?
So yeah, exactly. There is a bit of a disconnect in terms of economic performance and energy in terms of the electricity sector as well. So as you mentioned, demand for oil, you know, still surprisingly strong. Same thing for energy, but that's perhaps not so surprising because of the factors you mentioned, especially the heat this summer. Now, I personally think that given the incredible heat waves that China experienced and, you know, geographic extent still quite large, even with last year as the comparison. And nevertheless, there have not been any major outages. And it seems to have dropped a little bit out of the news feed that the concerns about outages. And in part, that's because of new capacity coming online. And of course, it also depends on the weather from week to week, not just on a seasonal basis. So yes, we see that hydro is down quite dramatically, down 34% actually for hydro production, indicating that that drought condition that affected power supplies a year ago is still in effect and could have consequences if the weather doesn't cooperate. But on the other hand, we do see, as I mentioned, a new capacity coming online. So most importantly, probably is the 26 gigawatts of new coal that was added in the first half. And that is really being used to make up that for that hydro deficit that the country is experiencing, especially in certain regions. And then also you see just stupendous additions, and it's no surprise since we covered this a month ago, but now the first half of the year data is out. So China added 78 gigawatts of solar PV, and that's basically almost as much as China added in the whole year of last year, which itself was a record, incredibly high number. So it's looking like now the total additions for the full year, since the second half is usually the stronger half for solar and wind additions, you'd expect that China would probably add at least 140, 150 gigawatts of solar. Again, just stupendous numbers. Then wind as well, making very good performance there with well over 22, 23 gigawatts of wind capacity added in the first half. And energy production from wind and solar are up 23%. So this is not just new capacity, the energy production is increasing as well. It's not going to be as much as that coal coming in to replace the lost hydro, but it's still a very impressive number in terms of the capacity that's being added and the energy production. So, yeah, surprisingly, no power outage, no power crisis so far this year, despite adverse weather. And in the last few weeks, it's been cooler, and you've seen less discussion. So maybe that leads in a little bit to the question of gas then. Last month, we talked about a slow recovery in gas use and limited appetite for spot LNG cargoes. Now, it sounds like there are a bunch of changes afoot in China's gas markets. There are some new reforms out, some new pricing rules. What can you tell us about these changes and how important are they?
First thing to say about these changes is that we don't fully know what they are. So there have been NDRC policy documents, and I think there was one also for kind of power sector reform and the dual targets that you'll talk about a bit later. We haven't seen the actual papers. There's been reports of those papers and snippets and readouts from the various press agencies. The same is true for gas. One thing to say just on the data, we have had the Natural Gas Development Report, which is a publication that the NEA issues every year that kind of takes stock of demand and a little bit on the outlook. So we've seen gas demand increase by around 5% in the first half of the year, which is a relatively good showing and pretty much on par with GDP activity, with GDP expansion. A lot of that, as we've been saying, came from domestic production, which is still going very strong. But the gas development report was interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, it talks about a 50% import threshold for China, which I think is the first or the second policy document to state that explicitly, that China wants to cap gas imports at 50%, which means that all producers have to really try and step on the gas, no pun intended, with our domestic output and try and increase it as much as possible to limit import growth. It does also talk about CCUS, about carbon capture, utilization, and storage, which very few policy documents in the past have done it so sort of closely to ensure the development of the gas sector, and that a lot of the infrastructure needs to be hydrogen ready. So clearly a more sort of holistic thinking about the role of gas in the energy transition and how it has to help the transition going forward. So the other policy document was price reforms issued by the NDRC. We don't know exactly what is in the NDRC document, but we have seen around 20 cities in China raise domestic residential prices. It's 13 to 15% increases, depending on the city. And really, this comes in the backdrop of the winter shortages that we saw in Hebei province. And what happened there was that international prices were rising. The distribution companies were making lower margins because residential prices are capped. And so they were selling only what they had contracted and what they really had to deliver to residential users, cutting off any sort of more expensive supplies to residential users. So the idea here is to increase residential prices a little bit and to help distribution companies alleviate some of those pressures so that they can pass through some of the costs and ensure supplies during the winter months. Now, from the residential consumer's point of view, these increases are not huge. It doesn't impact affordability massively. I mean, it is a 15% increase, but the prices are very low for residential users. So it should be affordable and it shouldn't negatively weigh on demand. The question is, does it really incentivize distribution companies to sell more during the winter? They sort of now do not have political cover to say our margins are weak, so we cannot sell to end users because the government has just given them this ability to increase prices. But a lot of it also depends on their contract prices from the upstream sellers. So it can be from the majors, and CNPC tends to like to increase its prices ahead of the winter. Or if they go out and sign LNG contracts and have their own supplies. So that could mean, again, that they can supply more to residential users. But obviously, the preferred customers are industrial and commercial customers that pay higher prices. So all this to say, it doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to see much higher demand from China, from residential users. But this is a step towards more rational pricing mechanisms and one of these ongoing sort of reform projects that moves in fits and starts. But when you see a crisis, like we had a mini crisis this winter, it does lead to additional changes. We're going to have to see how this plays out. How many cities actually increase prices? Do they decrease prices when they fall? And the other interesting thing is that the distribution companies are supposed to start publishing data. That would be really great if they started doing that, because then we would be able to monitor progress on that. But moving, I want to bring Philip into the conversation now. Here we've talked about renewables, we've talked about coal and gas. The other bit is nuclear. And just this week, and just to timestamp this, we're recording on the 2nd of August. Just this week, we've heard about new nuclear approvals. Philip, what do they mean? What should we read into the announcement, if at all?
Yeah, I mean, the government has just approved 4 reactors at 2 sites for construction, totaling 4.8 gigawatts, which sounds nice, but it's actually very modest. I mean, you have 53 gigawatts of nuclear in operation already, 26 gigawatts under construction. And these 4 reactors are just 4 out of 44 that are planned. 44 reactors are planned. So yeah, it's just 4 out of 44 reactors. And so this is just routine approval of something that was going to happen anyway. It's just a matter of when.
Interesting. But these things seem to be sort of plodding along. And I guess where a lot of people focus on what China isn't doing for decarbonization, it is important to notice that there are things that continue apace compared to renewables that are accelerating. Anders, I mean, it seems to me like there is some movement on policy design, on moving with more sort of fundamental and structural issues, even if it's only from sort of a declaratory level. That, again, we've had this firefighting mode to a certain degree, and now we're back to longer term thinking with some of these developments on the policy front, including power policies. So do you see any progress on power markets, on carbon markets? What do you make of these latest changes, moves, announcements, as opaque as they are?
Yes, I think you put that exactly correctly, which is that there's not a lot of detail, but there are steady moves to continue at least having some progress and some new documents coming out. I think there are 2 major new documents that relate to the power sector, one of which is related to dual control, which is a policy that controls enterprises and provinces, energy consumption and energy intensity. Those policies have for quite some time been discussed as needing to shift to dual control, not so much of energy consumption as dual control maybe of emissions. In other words, you can use more energy if that's low carbon energy, otherwise you're still controlled. So adding renewables would not bust you through your energy quota. That has been talked about, as I said, for some time. And there was a new announcement, state council saying that this should be put into effect back in June. However, this was an interesting announcement because it included a number of caveats or work items, work tasks that need to be completed before that happens, which, of course, very logical that you need to have monitoring, reporting, and verification for carbon emissions before you can shift from energy control towards a carbon dual control. So I think that points to the need to go slowly and deliberately on that front. And then similarly, in the power sector, there was at the same time an announcement that there would be a new draft regulation on constructing a national power system, which already China had the goal of establishing the design by 2025 and then be fully implemented by 2030 now on a national basis. And then at the end of July, this draft did indeed come out, although not publicly, only the outline is what I have access to. And this lists all of the normal provisions that you would expect there to be in such an outline, such as the regulation for national power trading centers, regional power trading centers, local power trading centers, and regulations for interprovincial trading, cross-regional trading, and so forth. But unfortunately, it doesn't have any of the details. And I suspect the actual document doesn't have a lot of details. It's more overall principles and a general structure to base the actual regulations on. So this is, again, a national regulation, a national framework, but I think a lot of the really nitty-gritty details will still be taking place on the provincial level anyway. Those are where the power markets so far have been designed and implemented, not at the national level. The national level is mostly at the level of frameworks and overall conventions. So that's my perception, that reform is proceeding and it's moving at a slow, deliberate pace. And Mikhail, that seems to be also what John Kerry heard when he visited China last month. What can you say about that? Did we learn anything from that visit? I don't think any great breakthrough was expected, but was his visit just having taken place, was that enough for this year?
Seems like the theme of our podcast today is sort of a mixed bag and maybe just enough. Enough for what? Enough for who? I mean, enough for climate. She said that China would chart its own path, that it would go its own way. Right? That was at the conference to mark China's sort of ecological day in the middle of July. You know, the fact that it took place was positive, and it came after a slew of meetings between US and Chinese officials that are really looking to, I think, ease some of the tensions. It feels to a certain degree, and I might be preempting here, that peak hawkishness against China in the US is now sort of past, that there are more voices, and not all of them are uber hawkish on China in the US, that have come maybe as part of these visits and in an attempt to just make sure that relations are a bit more stable and that Xi Jinping and President Biden can meet later this year. It might be because of domestic politics, or it might be on both sides, or it might just be the need to work together. But for climate, there was nothing sort of more ambitious. There was nothing that came out. We haven't seen any progress on methane from the Chinese side or any sort of joint pledges. So, I mean, and then you can read it any way you want, right? Because it really depends on what China's doing. We've just talked about all the new coal additions, and then you could sort of say, well, no, it's not enough. But you can also point to everything that China is doing on renewables and on sort of developing its ability to pursue and even accelerate its energy transition, and then it's positive, but it's sort of disconnected from what happened between Kerry and Xie Zhenhua and his counterparts in Beijing. I mean, you would note that Xi Jinping did not meet with Kerry while he was there. He did meet with Henry Kissinger, who was also visiting. Does that tell us anything? I don't know. But the fact that it took place was good and was positive, as are sort of the conversations between the US and China.
And do you think that this lack of any kind of progress at that meeting is just a result of the fact that it's a US-China meeting and that perhaps China is holding some climate or energy commitment back to offer perhaps to a senior European leader that might visit with a goal of making a breakthrough on climate?
That doesn't seem to be the case either. I mean, we've had Macron, we've had Scholz visit, we've had EU Commission going in and out of China. And I think there was a dialogue in early July on climate and environment where the EU wanted China to commit to a more aggressive peaking schedule, and China didn't do that. So I think the message that China is going to go at its own pace, but it is going, and it is committed. I think it is very much communicated both to European and American audiences. What the EU and China have been talking about is the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, CBAM, where in rhetoric, China has been pretty forceful about saying this is a protectionist measure and China won't go with it. But in reality, it does recognize that it needs to understand, tackle it, and communicate with the EU. So there have been agreements to talk about CBAM, which is probably a positive development. But of course, where the European Union differs from the US is that China plays on the divergences and on the differences in both industrial climate policies between the member states and Brussels. But I think on that kind of commitment to the energy transition, the message is similar to all counterparts. But if we are on this issue of international trade and negotiations, I mean, the other thing that we have seen with the EU is rising EV sales from China to the EU, which brings us to the topic of sort of new energy supply chains and critical materials. And I want to bring you, Philip, back into the conversation. We have been working on understanding China's role in critical materials and in the clean energy transition. Of course, the biggest thing that happened, or one of the big things that happened starting yesterday, actually, was that gallium and germanium are on the sort of list of not really export bans, but there is a sort of an export ban in progress on gallium and germanium. Now, they're not the highest on the list of clean energy critical materials. They're not rare earths, but these restrictions are significant for chips and other things. What do you make of that? What does that tell us about China's willingness and ability, I guess, to kind of play rough in the critical minerals game?
Well, gallium and germanium are used in very small quantities in solar photovoltaic technologies. And China accounts for more than 90% of gallium production and sales across the world and more than 60% of germanium. And interestingly, both metals are byproducts of other ores. So the issue is about processing primary ores such as bauxite and zinc and metals like that. It shows that China is willing to put constraints on exports. But let's recall that it controls exports of many items for its own reasons, let alone looking outside. Oil products are clearly an example. There are quotas for oil products. There are quotas for rare earth metal exports. Of course, we recall 2010-2011, the rapid clampdown on exports there. But even from year to year, quarter to quarter, they control exports of rare earth elements. So this is part of China's way of doing business. But this particular example of germanium and gallium shows that, yes, if they want to make a point, then they can. And I think particularly it's interesting that in the first half of 2023, the rate at which Chinese companies were investing in overseas ore deposits accelerated. So it's not just the processing and mining at home, it's the processing and mining overseas that strengthens its position even further. So turning to you, Anders, I mean, gallium and germanium are just one element in a whole range of supply chains linked to clean energy, where China has strong dominance and leadership. And particularly, there's been a lot of talk about batteries and electric vehicles, which is another manufacturing area where China is very strong. But we've heard about price wars in China between EV manufacturers, and the IEA is talking about Chinese gasoline demand peaking in 2025 because of the rapid EV sales. Anders, can you tell us a bit more about the state of play in China on electric vehicles?
Well, we had a stupendous year in 2022 for EV sales growth, up 100%. And it doesn't look like we are going to be able to match that this year. And that was based earlier on projections from the relevant industry associations. But then just looking at the first half of the year, we seem to be kind of on track, or maybe not even on track, to meet those kind of big forecasts for maybe 8 million electric new energy vehicle sales of new energy vehicles would be mainly electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electrics. And so for the first half, 3 million electric vehicle NEV sales, that, you know, is not enough to make halfway to the 8 million mark that was forecasted. Now, sales usually do pick up in the next half, so we should still be roughly on track, maybe, but it's hard to say. Definitely not surprising to the upside is what I can summarize there. And interestingly, the plug-in hybrids seem to be doing better in terms of their market share growth than the pure electric vehicles, which I think is kind of interesting. You asked about energy storage in general, batteries in general. We've seen new low prices for batteries and battery materials, indicating that the kind of rather slower market for electric vehicles has impacted the demand a little bit. And then in addition, China is installing record capacity of energy storage, battery electric energy storage on the grid, which is, of course, taking up some of the demand for slack for electric vehicle batteries, even though there might be different chemistries, different architecture for the batteries, but many of the same materials are being used. Many of the same companies are involved. In terms of the electric vehicle demand for electricity, that is not slowing down. The demand for electricity to charge electric vehicles, according to the EV Charging Infrastructure Promotion Alliance, that the electricity demand has gone up by 50% in the first half of this year as compared to a year ago. And of course, that reflects the growth in EVs on the roads, not just this year, but also last year. But that does sort of show that people are using these EVs, that this is really becoming a serious form of mobility. So I still think that we probably are on track to reach a 50% EV market share by 2025. And perhaps China can start thinking about setting goals related to phasing out internal combustion vehicles for, let's say, even just individual cities or individual provinces that have large amounts of EVs on the roads already. So far, no announcement in those areas. So that's one of the things I've been watching for over a year and still hasn't happened. But I still think we're on track in the longer term time frame. So, you know, speaking of what we're looking at, Philip, before we conclude, what will you be watching for the second half of this year?
Well, I'll go back to metals, and I'll be watching whether this acceleration by China's companies in overseas investment in mines and processing, whether that continues to push ahead fast. And also, on the other side of the coin, how effective the US and Europe are at implementing their own plans to, as it were, disengage partially or de-risk their supply chains on metals and associated equipment. And for you, Mikhail, same question.
I think the biggest thing I will be looking to see is whether or not we will get more details on the gas price reforms, be they official, if we get the June NDRC document published, but also additional documents both on oil and gas reform and gas prices. There was some talk about LNG futures trading. So the extent to which, again, we get both the policy statements, but also, and perhaps more interestingly, what happens in terms of implementation, how many more cities adjust prices, how frequently, whether this also leads to adjustments in industrial and commercial prices. And I'd be very intrigued to see if we actually get prices or demand data published on the distributor companies' websites that will help us glean some insights into where that is heading. And Anders, let me turn it back to you. What else are you watching?
Yeah, a couple of things that I always pay attention to. Number one is the renewable share in power generation overall, which in the past 2 years has risen by roughly 2 percentage points per year. And I expect that to increase by more now that the capacity is rising faster than it ever has before. And power demand, of course, is not rising as fast as it had been rising in recent years. So that would be very hopeful for the energy transition and for peaking carbon earlier than 2030. The other things that I'm looking for is there's the whole county PV program, which I've written about. Now, there have been some problems reported in this program, but nevertheless, residential PV installations continue to hit new all-time highs. And then in addition, you see some provinces like Shandong province instituting midday time of use prices, valley pricing, because basically there's excess supply of solar energy in the middle of the day. So I'm going to be watching to see what happens with this whole county PV program, whether some of the problems get resolved and what the level of achievement, whether maybe in the 2-year anniversary, as that comes up in September, what will we learn about whether counties have actually achieved their targets? The official targets are supposed to be by the end of the year, but I think we're going to start hearing about counties by the end of September saying, we've achieved these. And remember, this is a program where almost half the counties of China now are participating. It requires 20% of residential rooftops to have PV, plus a lot of commercial and industrial government rooftops. And this could really drive major uptake of clean energy, not just this year, but I think going into the future as the country seems to be moving in a direction towards greater acceptance and interest in distributed energy instead of just centralized energy. So those are the main things that I'm looking for. With that, that's all the time we have for today, unfortunately. Philip, Michal, I'd like to thank both of you. And of course, I'd also like to thank you, the audience, for joining. I hope you've appreciated our discussion today. We, as always, welcome your feedback and thoughts, and we look forward to our next discussion and hope you'll join us next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.